Main menu.
Hello and welcome to Main Menu, ACB Radio's look at technology from a blindness perspective. This week, Matthew Horspool brings us another edition of News Briefs. Stay up to date with the happenings in the technology field from a blindness perspective. Next, Jamie Pauls brings us another Access Watch. This time, he talks about the Stamp ID3 Tag Editor. Finally, we hear two presentations from the ViTech podcast. The first is on RSS and podcasting, and the second is on computer networking. That is our content for this week on 2 hours of Main Menu. If you would like to contact us, you may feel free to do so by sending an email to mainmenu@acbradio.org. That's mainmenu@acbradio.org. You may subscribe to our mailing list by sending a blank email to main-menu-subscribe@googlegroups.com. That's main-menu-subscribe@googlegroups.com. Finally, you may keep up with us on the web through two means. First, our Twitter page is available at twitter.com/mainmenu. That's twitter.com/mainmenu. You may also watch our blog. That is at mainmenu.acbradio.org. That's mainmenu.acbradio.org. Stay tuned. Here comes Main Menu.
Leading news briefs this week, Dr. Richard Mander, former chief executive of HumanWare, has resigned in protest after HumanWare's owners, Jollymont Capital, announced that their headquarters would be moving from Christchurch, New Zealand, to Montreal, Canada. Dr. Mander is being replaced by Gilles Pepin, founder of VisuAid, now part of the HumanWare Group, to whose headquarters HumanWare will move. Charles Gillies, owner of Jollymont Capital, said that the moving of the key decision-making and management roles to Canada would ensure HumanWare remain close to market trends, distributors, key customers, and partners. The New Zealand building will now be used solely for product development. HumanWare have also announced that they plan to release the long-awaited KeySync update along with a patch to KeySoft 7.5 within the next few days. Customers are asked to keep checking the HumanWare website at www.humanware.com for more information. They can also subscribe to the Braille Notes or BN Announce email lists by sending a blank email message to braillenote-request@list.humanware.com or bnannounce-request@list.humanware.com, respectively, with the word subscribe in the subject line, and reply to the confirmatory message. A new camera designed for reading handwriting is now available for the portable SenseView closed-circuit television from GW Micro at the introductory price of $99 US. For more information, visit GW Micro's website at www.gwmicro.com. David Dales is a writer of comprehensive VIP software guides for screen reader and screen magnifier users. He has recently completed a guide to the Gmail service for screen reader users. His website is at vip.chowo.co.uk. There are now two email lists for discussion of the new Victor Reader Stream from HumanWare. The first is managed by Bruce Taves, and to subscribe, send a blank email message to vrstream-request@ogts.net with the word subscribe in the subject line, and then reply to the confirmatory message. A new list has now been created specifically for people in the United Kingdom, and to subscribe, send a blank email message to victorstreamuk-subscribe@googlegroups.com and again reply to the confirmatory message. The Blind Vista list has been established to facilitate discussion of the new Windows Vista operating system from Microsoft by blind people. To join, send a blank email message to blindvista-subscribe@yahoogroups.com and reply to the confirmatory message. An email list has been created for those who wish to give or obtain help with the hypertext markup language, or HTML, used to create today's websites. To join, send a blank email message to blind_html-request@freelists.org with the word subscribe in the subject line and reply to the confirmatory message. Benetech, owners of the Bookshare project, now have several new job opportunities. For more information, visit www.benetech.org. And finally this week, the American Printing House for the Blind, APH, have released a new beta version of Studio Recorder, their sound recorder editor designed for spoken word content. Available from www.aph.org/beta. This build contains improved saving of WAV files and a batch converter. And that's news briefs for this week.
This week's software review comes straight from the JAWS user's website. Under the Programs link, you'll find a program called Stamp ID3 Tag Editor. This is a very small program that does exactly what its name suggests. It allows you to add ID3 tag information to MP3 files. I like it because you don't have to open another program to accomplish this task. It's very simple to use, and it does exactly what it's supposed to do. Again, go to www.jaws-users.com and check out that program along with a lot of other programs there that you may be interested in. And come visit us at www.accesswatch.info. Check out our blog at http://accesswatch.wordpress.com. If you'd like to contact me, you can email Jamie Pauls, that's JamiePauls, @gmail.com. Have a great week.
Well, welcome to this brand new episode of ViTech, in which we're going to be talking about RSS readers. Now, RSS stands for Really Simple Syndication, and it's a way for you to subscribe to websites, usually news articles or websites with some kind of news on them, and to get information delivered in a format that you can use, which means you don't have to go to the actual website. An example would be blindbargains.com, where if you subscribe to their RSS feed, every time there's a new bargain posted, you will actually receive, if your RSS reader is on, you will actually receive a new article in that RSS reader, and sometimes it alerts you and lets you know. When it checks for new articles, it will find a new post from Blind Bargains, and then you're in, usually, typically the RSS readers present either a list or a menu, and you can just scroll down and choose the article you want to read. Usually the place in the article. So, of course, with me today is Matthew and Brandon, and they have different experiences with RSS, and a lot of programs are implementing RSS, including Firefox and IE. Have you guys used any of those? Or?
Yeah, I use the IE support for RSS quite a bit.
I've used the Firefox support.
So what do you think of their RSS support? Do you think, how well do you think it's set up? Do you think it will work for screen readers? Or?
It's quite nice. I mean, as far as IE goes, you click on the feed. In fact, all you need to do is visit the URL. You don't even need to be subscribed to the feed. You can just visit the URL. And when you visit the URL, if you're not subscribed to it, there's a little link on the page that says subscribe to this feed. And you subscribe, you click the link and put a name in, and it subscribes you to the feed. And
yes.
When you view the feeds, then you've basically got a list of entries. And in IE, they are level 2 headings, which is very useful for screen readers such as JAWS, because we can press the letter H to move between the different feed items.
Or the number 2.
Or the number 2, yeah. And the layout is very simple. It's basically a heading level 2 with the name of the episode, and then the description, if there's a description. The description has to be specified by the author of the RSS feed. And then it will show a link to visit the page containing the article. And then it goes on to the next one, so it's very simple to navigate. And then in Internet Explorer, you can press a keystroke. I think it's either Control-J or Alt-J to move you to your feeds list. Select the feed that you want and press Enter on it, and it will take you to the page for that feed. Now, the one thing to be aware of in IE, just as a brief side note, it is extremely picky, and I mean extremely picky, in that if there's just one slight coding error in the RSS feed, IE won't display the feed at all, and it will just say, there's an error in this feed, please contact the feed author to resolve this problem, and there's a button for more information where it basically tells you where the error is, but it won't show the feed at all, and that's something to be aware of. If an RSS feed is coded sloppily, then it won't work.
Yeah,
Same with Firefox.
Yeah, so it's pretty much the same with Firefox, Brandon? Or
well, pretty much. RSS works pretty much the same in Firefox, except when you subscribe to a feed and you actually subscribe to it, it's placed in your bookmarks like a website, and when you look at it in the bookmarks, it has the title of the feed, and it's a submenu. When you go into that submenu, it has a list of the titles of the entries in the RSS feed.
That's
and
nice.
When you hit enter on it, it loads the page that it's referring to. Yeah, which is kind of nice, although it's not the same as IE. The feeds, when you go to a feed website, it does display the same as IE, and it's pretty much the same limitations. If there's an error in the feed, it won't display properly. You'll still be able to subscribe to it, but it won't.
Oh, you can still subscribe, but you won't be able to, certainly in IE anyway, you won't be able to view any of the articles that are in the feed.
Yeah. But, once you're subscribed to it, it works fine. I think it's kind of just a reason of ignorant browser developers, because really it's just a standards thing, and even though there's an error, 9 times out of 10, it's just that somebody wrote their RSS feed slightly different than what is, quote, respected, and browser manufacturers just sort of go with the norm, right? So.
And some errors, I mean, the Vitek podcast feed, which we'll come on to podcasting in more detail, but just to indicate the type of errors that can cause problems, in the show notes, I've put links in with the and sign, and those links won't work. Those links cause the feed to be unrenderable in IE and Firefox.
Yeah.
And some other programs. Just stupid little errors like that.
My experience with RSS has been kind of a unique one. I don't really have an accessible RSS reader on my computer. I don't need one. I have the icon, and I think that is actually the best application of RSS there is. Because the RSS reader, which you may have seen in the other podcast about the icon, is basically a tree view and a list view. You go down the first, when you load it, you're first in feeds, then you go right arrow and you're in news, podcasts, fun stuff, and you can create your own folders, of course. Then you get to the different feeds. You update all feeds. It tells you how many articles. What I usually do, I update all feeds when I'm at home with my wireless connection. Feeds are all updated. I go to work. I on my lunch, I can look at the latest blind bargains for the day or the latest news or anything that's on the icon.
And so And to honest with you, to be honest with you, that's the only, I think, the most elegant way to use RSS for news, and the only way I would personally use it. I never fell in love with any way of accessing RSS from the computer.
One thing that I actually, that I think RSS would be good for on the computer is metered dial-up connections. Same thing as email is. You check your email every hour. You only have to be connected for 5 seconds out of that hour, not, you know, 5 minutes and spend 10 cents a minute or whatever.
Unless you want to view the actual full article, because I don't think the article is in the RSS feed, is it?
In the icon it is. In the icon it caches. Now, I
it caches from the web, though, Aiden. It doesn't actually cache from the RSS. It caches, it goes out online and gets the article and caches it so that you don't have to have an active internet connection when you want to look at that article.
Right, but it's just downloading a bunch of text at once as opposed to keeping it online all the time. I think the computers do the same thing, don't they? I guess it depends.
No.
Okay.
Not unless you really set it up. Like, it's pretty simple on the icon because it's just one sort of setting, but in the computer you have to set. It's a little more confusing than it is on the icon.
I must admit, I haven't used very many RSS clients, but I've used a grand total of one external RSS client, which was Accessible RSS, and it was a very long time ago, and it's probably changed a lot since I used it. But when I
did it work with John?
Yes, it did. It was an Accessible RSS client.
I've seen one. I believe it's called Talking RSS or Speaking RSS or something. It was on the Giveaway of the Day website, which is a website that allows you to download software and use it for 1 day. It's got an interesting license code. You can use the software. You can just download and install it for 1 day. But it's this Talking or Speaking RSS client, I didn't really play with it that much. But it used Sappy. It used Sam to read its articles. Yeah, I, and of course, as soon as you started the program, it would obligingly read for you the latest articles. Yeah, I didn't really feel like having Sam tell me what was the top headlines on CNN. Now, I'm not saying you can't change that. You probably could change that, especially since eloquence can be a sappy voice.
Yeah.
So you probably can change that, but I didn't play with it too much because that experience was enough. But I could see where that would be good if you're, well, for example, for Blind Bargains, if you're, you know, doing something else on the computer and then Blind Bargains updates the site, you know, Sam or hopefully something a little bit better would say, Sports Watch for Talking Sports Watch for $54, and it would just tell you right away without you having to even go in there. So I can see, you know, when you're multitasking, RSS being really good for you, especially a program like that. But I know personally, I would want something that I could check with JAWS or another screen reader. Well, I'm not even going to bother getting one on the computer. I'm just sticking with the icon personally.
To be honest, as a multitasker myself, unless you're checking. For news, especially, unless you're checking a few, like 30 or 40 different websites for news, like if for some reason you really had to keep on top of an industry or something and you were checking like 30 or 40 news sites or something like that, that's the only way I could see RSS as being crucial to your sort of daily routine. I don't get how it actually increases productivity in terms of, unless you're a newbie to JAWS or something and you can't browse as quickly, I don't see it as being crucial to getting things done, which is what people sort of say. It's like, oh, it's so much more, you know, organized and you can get so much more done. I mean, it's like, but I can go to somewhere like Dig and get Dig's RSS feed has like 10 articles, but when I browse Dig, I read like 100 or so articles in terms of titles. Like, if I'm interested, I click through, right? But I mean, still, it's like,
Different people have different, you know, ways of doing things. I mean, I personally like the icon for what it is, so that I can sit on my couch and read articles without having to be connected and wasting the battery with wireless networks. I just connect once. It updates and caches all the articles. I turn off the wireless and it's
and on the icon,
good. I can't hear
the thing
myself.
Is on the icon, that's great because it does that. And I find that if there was an RSS client that did that, I would use it because it would actually be useful. Mm-hmm. But I found that many RSS readers on the computer don't do that. I mean, going back to Accessible RSS, which is at webby.org.uk. It doesn't. It just downloads the RSS feed, and you have a list box, and you click on the item in the list box, and it takes you out to a live web page.
I've used that, by the way. I've used WebIE, their little applications, and like many others have stated in a forum thread somewhere, I think it's counterproductive to have an application suite especially designed for the blind. And not only that, but it uses some weird podcast, because it supports podcasting now, it uses some weird directory, and I don't even know what it... It doesn't even have, like, all the popular podcasts, so it's, to me, it's no good.
You can always add podcasts. That's one thing the icon does.
But see, that's what I mean. Like, the way the icon does adding podcasts, it's elegant. But, like, to add a podcast on WebIE's RSS reader, Accessible RSS, you have to literally add the feed. I'm sorry, but, like, if I'm going to use something where I have to add the feed, I'll just use Juice, which is the podcatcher that I use, because, I mean, at least then I, like, some of the podcasts I add, I go through the directory, but some I add manually, and that's fine with me, because 3/4 of the podcasts that I add, I can find in the podcast alley directory that Juice comes with, and, you know.
Yeah, and we'll cover podcasting a bit later, but there's one final thing that I have to mention about RSS, which some people might find useful. Is there are certain web-based RSS readers, first of all. Actually, there are two things I need to mention. Web-based RSS readers I've never used and probably never will use, because to me that's sort of losing the point of RSS a bit if you're going to a website, because RSS is supposed to prevent you from going to a website. I suppose it keeps things organized and it allows you to check your RSS feeds wherever you are, but to me it's counterproductive.
The Google Reader, which is Google's little RSS reader, the reason people use that is because they can set up a personalized homepage with other feeds, and so it does prevent them from going to 30 different websites or whatever. That's why people use online podcasts. I mean, online RSS readers, because even though it's not a program running on your computer, it still saves them time. I think it's kind of redundant. But.
Something that some people might find really useful, though, is a system, and I can't name the system, unfortunately, but I've seen it used on the Skype English mailing list, actually, where somebody got this system where they subscribe to an RSS feed on a website, and if there's any new items on that feed, it will email the items. I don't really know how it works, but... I know that there are such systems available. Now, that, to me, is probably the most useful RSS reader I've ever seen.
Yeah, that's cool. I would love to set that up on for a mailing list, just to so that people... I mean, because that's a cool idea, right? And, I mean, if an RSS reader came to me in my inbox, I would almost use it, only because I'm already checking my mail 30 times a day. It's something I already do. I'm not... There's no added steps. Like, that's what should happen with an RSS reader. I mean, really, the only way I would use anything other than what I just described for RSS, outside of the icon, I would use the icon, is if the operating system that I was using had RSS features built right in. That's the only way I would use it.
Now, I'm a little bit, because I haven't used Juice, I'm a little bit confused. Juice is a podcaster. Is it also an RSS reader?
No.
Okay.
No, it's primarily a podcatcher, and it does all the BitTorrent. If you subscribe to a podcasting feed that's a BitTorrent feed, it will do the BitTorrent transfers for you.
Okay, so this is nice one thing. The whole concept of podcasting, and a podcast is basically an RSS feed. In its basic form, if you look at it technically. A podcast is an RSS feed with enclosures. To simplify things a bit, a podcast feed is basically an RSS feed, but instead of pointing to content, online content like text, it points to MP3 files or OGG files that one can download. And the purpose of a podcast, which I actually use more than I use RSS...
Same.
Yeah, is that you... put a feed into a podcatcher, and the podcatcher checks the feed every so often and downloads any new MP3 files.
Like Vitek, for example.
Like Vitek. Vitek is a... It's kind of ironic that we're talking about podcasting on a podcast, because Vitek is a podcast.
Yeah. So if you are viewing this from the web and you actually want to get your Vitek every Sunday, automatically, just like a paperboy almost, you would need a accessible podcatcher such as Juice or the Icon if you have it. You type in the Vitek your feed for the URL, which is on our homepage, and you can actually subscribe to the Vitek feed and send it a check every Monday morning, and it will do that. It will check and it will download.
Now, there are a couple of things just before we go on to the clients that you need to be aware of. Firstly, it's probably a good idea to set some sort of size limit on your podcasts folder, because I was once in a situation. I subscribed to another technology podcast called Blind Cool Tech, and those of you who are subscribed to Blind Cool Tech will know that that podcast has now gone up to about 15 gigs total in size. And I had all the episodes on my hard drive, and my hard drive ran out of space, and I started to wonder why. And I looked at my podcast folder, because I was subscribed to Blind Cool Tech. I was also subscribed to ACB Radio's Replay and Main Menu podcasts. I subscribed to a few more, and the podcast folder had got up to about 159 gigs in size. Right, so you need to be aware that if you are subscribed, I mean, especially if you subscribe to a number of podcasts, which is very easy to do, I must admit, if you subscribe to a number of podcasts, it will eat your disk space after a while. And if you're subscribed to a couple of hundred podcasts, it'll eat your disk space in a few weeks.
Yeah, it's in Juice, you can clean up. There's a clean up tab, and you can specify that you want to delete stuff within a certain amount of days, if that will help.
Yeah, the icon does that too. I believe you can set it for like.
Right, but it's just something to be aware of, is that it will. And the other thing, of course, is if you've got Juice or your podcast client set to download new episodes, I have them set to check every 30 minutes. And if that's the case...
So do I.
If that's the case, what might happen is you might get into a situation where you're downloading a file from the web at 300 kbps, and all of a sudden it drops dramatically to, you know, and you start to wonder why. Your podcast client will be downloading episodes. It can eat bandwidth up quite a bit, and it'll do it without your knowledge as well. So that's another important thing to note.
But I mean, it will only use bandwidth when it has, you know, you're not going to, you know, it's not going to use any more bandwidth than it would if you knew about it.
Yeah, you're right that it won't take up any more bandwidth than it would if you have the knowledge. But the point is, you don't have the knowledge, and if you are you want to use that bandwidth that it's taking up, you might start to wonder what's taking up the bandwidth. Because, I mean, in my case, I ran Juice on a Saturday morning and came on a Monday morning, and woke up on the Monday morning and completely forgot that Juice was running.
I'm so used to it, right? Because it downloads at the same time every week. Once you get into the habit of watching it, like if you just check, like it downloads, most things come out at the same time, and you start to get into the pattern, and it's not so much of an issue. At first it was. I'm not going to deny that it was an issue at first, but I mean, once you got used to it, it's okay. And not only once I got used to it, but I mean, if it was really that much of a problem, I could set a download limit. So if you know your download speed, you can just set, like, maybe half.
Yeah.
And then you can have your bandwidth for browsing and downloading files if you need it.
There are other podcasts where...
Yeah, I was just going to mention... we're all talking about the Juice Receiver. The Juice Receiver has had a lot of publicity. It was one of the most inaccessible podcast readers around for a long while. It was formerly known as iPodder, and then... you know, when podcasting really started to take off, blind people such as Jeff Bishop, who is really into podcasting at RSS, worked with the author to work out the accessibility bugs, and iPodder version 2 came out, which fixed a load of bugs, and then it was renamed to Juice because of a lawsuit, and we won't go into that.
Apple filed a lawsuit.
Primarily because I don't know all the details myself.
Thing that I was thinking about, we should probably talk about podcast directories, because it's all very well to talk about podcasts if people don't know where to get them. So, which directory is Vitek on at the moment?
Vitek's on most of them. It's on Podcast Alley, and it's on Dig, and it's on digitalpodcast.com. A podcast directory is a website or a directory where people submit their podcasts and, you know, descriptions, and it tracks the podcasts.
And give it to RSS. And so most RSS readers have podcast directories set up, or you can set up your own. So, for example, we added Vitek to the podcast directories. And then if you download an RSS reader, it then... If it has the right directory, or if you add the directory, I guess, it will pick out Vitek. People can be browsing podcasts and say, oh, what podcast do I have? And one of them is Vitek. I'm guessing Juice has that directory that we added Vitek to it?
Yeah. I think how it works, don't you type in keywords or genres or something, and it brings up a list? I mean, podcast directories is something that I haven't used. I tend to add feeds manually.
Mostly that's how I add feeds to...
Yeah, so you just you add podcasts, and then I mean there's a lot of different types of podcasts. I mean we are a technology podcast like Blend Cool Tech or Buzz Out Loud. But I mean there are a lot of different kinds. There are old time radio podcasts. Some magazines are, and there's a magazine for the blind sound computing, but it's not just limited to blind software. There are sighted podcasts. There are even video podcasts. So there's a lot of different types of podcasts. So if you're interested in podcasts, probably the best thing to do would be to search for, if you're interested in a specific category, anything from technology to books to even old radio to video podcasts.
Even modern radio.
Search for it on Google and you'll probably find it.
Modern radio, you'll find that the BBC and the UK, and I don't know about any others, but the BBC and the UK are podcasting a lot of their programs. So, I don't know, highlights from the Terry Wogan program, which goes out on our national radio station every weekday, and I can subscribe to that as a podcast and listen to it at my leisure. So, even popular programs have been archived.
So yeah, if you're looking for a podcast, my advice would be to Google it. Or if you're looking for something on the BBC, I'd go to the homepage and search for it. Just Google whatever you're looking for: podcast, radio podcast, technology podcast, probably music podcast. A lot of different types of podcasts.
Just personal podcasts. I mean, we haven't really mentioned this, but podcasting went through a huge craze a couple of years ago, and a load of podcasts sprung up. For example, the Darcy and Hobby Show, and Byron's Journal, and I can't think of any others, but there are loads of them, just personal podcasts where people might, I don't know, a bit like a blog, but in audio. Hi, I'm Matthew Hall, and I'm now in my school, and I'm going to show you what goes on in my lessons, and then the next day I say, hi, I'm Matthew Horsley.
You can see a lot of that.
Perkins Brailler part. And it might just be anything I think of. You know, sound scene tours from my holiday or anything. They're just personal podcasts.
Now, if you want that, you can go to Blend Cool Tech as well, because they have a lot of that kind of stuff as well. But yeah, people can, if you're interested in a particular person, they've decided to put their stuff on a podcast, you can listen to them. Anyone can do a podcast, as long as they have the right tools. You need, obviously, to make it into an MP3, and then a way of uploading it to the website. And then, if the name's in the right format and it's in the directories, people will download it.
Okay, so to that end, let's discuss. I'm sure people are wondering, insistently wondering, how do we record Vitek? Matthew, can you give a little insight into that?
Yeah, I can certainly speak to that, and there are basically three processes involved, or three sections involved. There is the recording process, then there's the editing process, or the production process, depending on what you want to call it, and then there's the publication process. And these processes have pretty much stayed the same since our inception back in June 2007, but... of course, first of all, as I said, we have to record the podcast, and to record the podcast, we use the Skype program from www.skype.com. Skype is a voice chat program, which we'll probably talk about a bit more in a later edition of this podcast.
And we also use the MX Skype recorder, which is at www.skyperec.com. That's www.skyperec.com. The MX Skype recorder is an add-in for Skype, which will record the conversations. There are various other Skype recorders, for example, the Skylook plugin for Microsoft Outlook, the CallBurner software, the Pamela software, and indeed we've tried other software in the past. You'll realize, of course, that the quality of some of the earlier episodes hasn't been as good as it is now. That's because in some of the previous episodes we've been using a program called Pamela to record the Skype conversations, and the biggest problem that we found with Pamela was, as I said before, the quality isn't all that wonderful. However, there are problems with MX Skype Recorder as well, the most noticeable being that echo issues can be present quite a bit, and we need to make sure that there aren't any echoes in the podcast before we start, and has happened on occasion that a podcast has been recorded with echoes and we've had to do our best to edit those out and not done particularly well. Another problem I found with the MX Skype recorder is that it's not particularly reliable. That is, on some systems it works very well, on some systems it works absolutely terribly. By this I mean that when it's running, there's generally quite a stuttery sound over the Skype connection. Not necessarily for the people who you're talking to, but if you're the recorder, then everybody else sounds like they're stuttering, although you sound fine. The actual recording sounds okay, but the what you're listening to as you record doesn't. And on some systems it's not too bad. On some systems, you know, it just works and no problem. I mean, there is some stutter, but it's manageable. On some systems it just stutters such a lot that the whole program is impractical. And on some systems, such as my desktop computer downstairs, it stutters so much that it crashes Skype and itself at the same time, which is not particularly amusing. So basically what happens is somebody will initiate a conference. Normally this is Brandon, and Brandon will call everybody up at a certain time, usually about 19 hours UTC on a Thursday or on a Monday, which is 2 p.m. in the afternoon Eastern time, 11 a.m. Pacific time. And we sort of bring ourselves into the conference and have a bit of a chat, and then we get down to the actual recording session itself. And the recording session itself generally lasts about 2 hours, 2.5 hours. It's quite a long recording session, generally because we get sidetracked quite a bit and we don't start on time very often. I mean, what'll generally happen is we'll be part of the conference and spend half an hour talking, you know, just generally talking, and also preparing things as well. I didn't really mention the preparation steps. That is because there really isn't much of a preparation step. We pretty much, I send out an email to everybody and say, hey, we're going to be recording such and such today, and we all come into Skype, and then we sit round and say, okay, so who's going to talk about what, or who can talk about what. For example, with the podcasting one, we decided, okay, so Brandon and I have used Juice, and Aiden's used the Icon, and Brandon's used Firefox, I've used IE, and so on and so forth. So that generally takes a while. So we record the podcast, then the file goes to me for editing. Actually, more recently, I've been recording the episodes. So anyway, the files come to me for editing in one way or another. And the editing process then basically involves taking out where we get sidetracked. And that's the primary purpose of editing. Also to edit out any sort of language that might be considered offensive. So, for example, you know, if we get sidetracked talking about the lawsuit with Apple, for example, in this podcast, we did actually get sidetracked because I said that Apple had sued Juice, and then we ended up talking about the ethics of suing people and such. And as I said, the purpose of editing is basically to get rid of that stuff. Also to try and edit out language. Also to try and edit out where people are just plain distracted. If there's lots and lots of ums and ahs in a sentence, then my job is to get those out. My job isn't to eliminate ums and ahs entirely, because otherwise it just doesn't sound natural. We want it to sound as natural as possible, but there are certain things where you suddenly think, oh, why, you know, I need to cut that out. Also, if we're in the middle of talking and the phone goes, and of course we don't want the sound of a telephone in the middle of a podcast, so we let the person take the call and then come back, and then we edit the phone call out and try our best. So the editing process generally takes about as long as the recording process did. Let's say a recording process takes 2 hours. I chop the beginning off and I chop the end off, because that's generally a personal discussion which you don't really want to feature in the podcast. Then I edit the bits that I do want to appear in the podcast and try and edit it down to an hour in length, or possibly a bit less than an hour in length. And then sometimes it's necessary to record an intro and an ending. Sometimes it's not. It depends who's hosting and who's recording generally. In this episode, we haven't had to record anything. In fact, we just recorded the intro, we recorded the ending as part of the recording of the panel discussion itself. However, for some of the episodes, for example the ICC discussion and the blogging discussion, we recorded the intro and ending separately to the actual panel discussion. So of course, if we do that, then that needs to be recorded. And the final process of the editing is to mix in the opening theme and closing theme, which are in an MP3 file that I have, and I can fade in and fade out as necessary. And to edit, I use the program SoundForge, which was formerly from Sonic Foundry, and Sonic Foundry was bought out by Sony, so it's now Sony SoundForge. I still use Sonic Foundry's version though, so I use SoundForge version 6, which is doing me just fine. The final process is to edit it down. Once we've edited it down, convert it into an MP3 file. And the reason why we do this is just because MP3 files are smaller than WAV files. WAV file is raw sound data, and as you can imagine, it's pretty big. We're probably talking, for Vitek, we're probably talking about a 300 meg WAV file. That's how big the WAV file is when it's edited down and everything. So obviously, to try and save some disk space on our server and to decrease your downloading time and bandwidth consumption, we convert it into an MP3 file. We convert into 56 kbps, 22,050 Hz mono, which I think works just fine, because Skype isn't as high quality as personal voice anyway, so it doesn't need to go too high, and we have had no complaints yet about the 56k file attribute, so I think we'll keep it. So we convert it to an MP3 file, then I put the ID3 tags in. ID3 tags are basically a way of labeling the MP3 file. So it can be done in Winamp. If you're playing a file in Winamp, you press Alt-3, and it takes you into the ID3 tag editor, where you can put in various things. And the reason why we do that is because our website was written by our former webmaster, Sean Randall, and he wrote us a nice little PHP script, which is basically a type of web page which would list all of the MP3 files on our website and give them titles and authors according to ID3 tags. This is why we ID3 tag our stuff. This is not the most common way of doing things. Many people use automatic feed generators, which we'll come on to in a bit. But we use a custom-built PHP script. So basically what I do is I upload an MP3 file. For example, this one will be called 16_RSS_and_podcasting.mp3. And once that file has been uploaded, the website will say, oh, hey, there's a new MP3 file. I'll put it into the podcast list, at the top of the list. And when I'm ready to upload the show notes are generally called 16_RSS_and_podcasting.mp3.txt, and when that mp3.txt is present, it will assume that's the show notes and print them. I can put anything in those show notes. I can put, you know, just bog standard HTML code straight into the text file, and the podcast generator will see it and it will print it out as raw HTML, which is very nice. Now, as I said to you, this isn't the most common way of doing things. A slightly more common way of doing things is to use a automatic feed generator. There are disadvantages, of course, and there are also advantages. The most prominent disadvantage is that you don't have much control over the technical aspects of your feed, and by that I mean the tags that are in the feed. And you probably don't really need to worry about this unless you're particularly technically inclined, but we have a particular way that we want our feed to look raw. And for example, we want iTunes support, so we build iTunes support in. If we were using an automatic feed generator, that would be more difficult to do. I mean, many automatic feed generators have iTunes support anyway, so it's not too big a deal, but it's just an example. We were able to build iTunes support in very quickly as soon as we knew how to do it, whereas some feed generators might not be able to do that. Similarly, if the RSS specification is improved, we would be able to adopt those improvements possibly before the auto feed generator is possibly out. But my point is, we can put anything we want. We could, if we wanted to, build our own specification and rewrite the feed generator to do that, whereas we couldn't on an automatic feed generator. And I'm not really sure, you know, how these automatic feed generators work. I've never really used them. A couple of examples that I can think of are FeedBurner at www.feedburner.com and Gcast, which is at www.gcast.com.
FeedBurner basically is a redirection service, and you enter your feed details, and then it gives you a, whatever you decide it to be, it'll be feeds.feedburner.com/something you provide to them, probably Vitek in our case, but we don't have one. Basically what FeedBurner does is it gives you stats, you know, how many people have hit the feed, basically, is what FeedBurner provides. Gcast is more of a podcasting service. It provides you free hosting. I'm not sure on the specifics, but they have, you can record via phone or submit MP3s to upload MP3s and create a feed that way. So they're two very different services. As far as I'm aware, Gcast doesn't give you stats. Somebody correct me if I'm wrong, email us, but I'm pretty sure that Gcast doesn't give you stats. But I guess the way we record Vitek could be done a little bit differently, I suppose. Pottercast and a few other podcasts that I know of use sort of, everybody records their own site. They're all on Skype like we are, and they record it through Audacity or something, and then somebody edits them all together. It's a lot harder to edit, but in the end it sounds a million times clearer, but it's so hard to edit. I would like to mention that if you want to start your own podcast, and you've got past the recording stage and you're looking for a place to host it and you don't have any money to spend, gcast.com is a nice free service where you can upload your recordings, whatever format you want, and you can specify, you know, put it in a feed, and you can, you know, it will do all the work for you, and you can just keep updating it. So if you really want to start something, you can use Gcast.
I think that's very good, because there are people who don't have much money and believe they can't do it, but
right,
it's possible for everybody.
Libsyn, another service that a lot of podcasts podcasters really like, because they have a very compliant feed, and it gets added to all the top directories automatically, and they have a directory of their own. So I think Libsyn's kind of a ripoff, because I think they're still kind of in the... their prices are... I guess they're okay if you don't really know what you're doing. But... it's just... I know they don't have a bandwidth limit, and it's totally just the space, but you can fill that up so fast.
Well, I think that's... I think that's pretty much today.
Yeah.
I think to get it's good for if you want to know more about podcasts, you can look at podcastvalley.com or just Google the genre you want.
There's also quite a good article on Wikipedia, which is the free encyclopedia on podcasting at en.wikipedia.org/wiki/podcast. And that's a very good article to get you started, and I'll put a link to that in the show notes.
Yeah, Wikipedia is good for things like that as well.
You can even Google how to podcast or how to start a podcast.
Yeah. Yeah, lots of good tutorials out there.
And of course, just before we finish, we should probably give out our contact information. If you'd like to email us, you can do so at vitechpodcast, that's vitechpodcast, at gmail.com. You can give us a ring in the United Kingdom on 0700-598-1840, or join our Vitech Podcast Google group by sending a blank email message to vitechpodcast, as before, -subscribe, that's SUBSCRIBE, at Google Groups, that's GOOGLEGROUPS.com. And don't forget, of course, you can visit us on the web at www.vitechpodcast.com.
Well, I hope everyone has a good week, and we'll see you again next Sunday.
Yep, see you again.
Hello and welcome to this exclusive episode of Vitech, Technology from a Brand's Perspective. Over the last few weeks you've heard the voices of Aidan and Matthew hosting the show, but now I have returned to host this episode on networking. We're basically going to be covering how to set up your own wireless network today and what one basically is. So without further ado, let's move straight on to the panel discussion. And first of all, we're going to explain what a network basically is. If you basically have two or more PCs in your house, and perhaps even a printer if you want to be adventurous, you want everybody else around the house to be able to use the internet as well, you know, because there's no point having just one PC online, because then you end up having people fighting over one PC. So, a router is a small box with sockets on the back, and in very simple terms, the concept is that a wire goes from your internet socket or box if you have an internet modem to the back of the router to give the internet access, and then you have four ports left on most routers to connect up to four PCs. And when those PCs connect, they can all connect to the internet at exactly the same time and surf the web at the same time. Now, let's first of all begin with Matthew, and let's just first of all begin by saying there are different manufacturers for routers as there are for everything else. So Matthew has a Belkin one, don't you?
Yeah.
What are your experiences with Belkin so far?
For the most part, actually, my experience with Belkin has been quite good. Although there were a few teething problems at first. The Belkin router was very, very easy to plug in and install and configure the way I liked it. everything was done on a web page, so I could just I was given a number, which for the more technically inclined, I was given the internal IP address of my router, which I then went to in the web browser. It gave me a configuration page, and it said, you know, here's what you can do. Do you want to have wireless mode on? Because this supports wireless internet as well. If you want to have wireless mode on, then what wireless channel do you want it to be on? I mean, this is really technical stuff, which for the most part you don't need to worry about. But it was all there if I wanted to change it. The only thing that I did have an issue with at first is that the network would sporadically go down. I might be on the internet for about an hour on wireless, and then all of a sudden, for no apparent reason, the network would just die. And it wouldn't just be wireless either, it would be the entire network. And the solution for that was just to put it on a different wireless channel.
Yeah,
That's been my finding.
Wireless channels are basically, I mean, it isn't too necessary that you know about it, but it is probably good to have an idea. Wireless channels basically, a wireless is a radio. It's called a wireless radio when it transmits wireless signals. They work on different frequencies, obviously, from your FM radio, or AM, but different things can interfere with them. Everything from lights to computers to radios to phones can interfere with your wireless network if it's on the wrong channel.
Now,
I mean, what you've got to remember is that anything can interfere with the wireless router.
You have to kind of experiment and see what channels actually work.
And if you're in an area where you have many people using wireless networks, like in most cities, channel 6, which is usually the default channel that most routers ship set to, is very crowded. So you might have a problem on that channel, but it's quite simple to change the channel on most routers.
Now, my Belkin router has a very nice feature on it. It has an automatic feature on it, so I can, and in fact it's set to this by default, and it will automatically look through the different channels and see which ones that
That's cool.
In every Belkin router that I've seen, whether it be in my house or my granddad's house or my next door neighbor's house, it's always defaulted to channel 1, even when channel 1 is obviously busy. So it doesn't work very well, but the option...
Oh, that's too bad.
Yeah, I mean, what you've got to remember is that anything will interfere with your wireless router, whether it be a wireless cordless phone, if you have one of those in your house, which, incidentally, in this room I've got 3. But anything could interfere, like microwaves even.
Well, now you can get away from that a little bit. For all intents and purposes, I know this isn't true in all cases. I think B or G, I'm not really sure which one doesn't, but they use the same gigahertz, 2.4 gigahertz, as most cordless phones. You may recognize the number even if you don't know what it means. And so if you have a phone in or around your house that uses that same frequency and channel, it may cause problems. So it's always beneficial to use a different channel if you're having problems, just to see if that fixes the problem.
Well, yeah, so you might be asking, what are the benefits of me going wireless, or even setting up a router for 2 or more PCs? Well, 2 or more PCs is obvious, because you can all get on at the same time without fighting with each other. Wireless network, again, you can be anywhere in the house or
there's lots of tiny devices that have wireless built in. And not only that, I mean, yeah, wireless is in, you know, desktops and laptops more specifically. But there's also like little tiny devices, like a little there's a desktop radio that will access internet radio, right? So there's all these devices that use wireless, and I mean, you don't even have to be in front of a computer. So
if you're one of those unlucky people who aren't in the UK and don't have a good internet plan for your cell phone, you can go on the normal internet and do things wirelessly.
Yes. Some cell phones, the Nokia N95, for example, and the Nokia internet tablet, which probably isn't accessible. You know, lots of technologies using Wi-Fi, and it's a lot of fun to use some of these devices.
Yeah, and we'll also get on to to home media extenders later on as well.
Yeah.
Like the sound pitch.
Stream, yeah, you can basically stream videos from your PC all over your house, but we'll get onto that later on in the podcast. So you might be wondering, what do I have to do to get set up with wireless? Well, you need two things. A wireless router. Three things, actually. A wireless router, an internet connection, and a network card for the PC. A wireless network card, of course, if your PC doesn't have wireless built in. Yeah. Which is a good point.
Do some motherboards have it built in?
Oh yeah, some laptops do.
Well, I know laptops do, but can you get motherboards for the PC with Wi-Fi built in?
No, I haven't seen any.
That'd be so cool.
But yeah, if you basically want to use a wireless card on your PC, there's two or three different types. You can either use a USB one, which is used most commonly on laptops, or PCMCIA.
I have a PCMCIA card. Actually, no, I have a PCI card.
Yeah, or you can use a PCI card in the back of your PC, which, as Brandon says, he's obviously you've got.
It's very reliable. Very reliable. It's like having it's like having another network card, like an RJ45 NIC. So it's just, in my opinion, it's just as reliable as a wired connection. Yes. Yeah. An Ethernet card, sorry.
Yeah, and all you do is you just set the router up. You turn on the router. I believe you need one PC connected to the router by a wired connection in order to configure it.
No, that's not true. That's what they recommend. It depends on how you've got your router set up, to be honest. If your router comes by default with wireless turned on and no security, then you don't need a computer to be wired. All the Linksys and D-Links that I've used are set up that way.
Yeah, most routers, if not all, are set up with wireless turned on.
I think it's good to have it in case there is any problem with wireless or anything interferes. It just sounds like a good idea to have at least one computer connected to the router.
They always recommend.
No, I agree with you, but
somebody's probably going to have a wired PC connected anyway.
I don't.
You don't have to. If you accidentally go messing around in your wireless configuration, and you let me just briefly touch on this later on, but just briefly say you can put passwords on your wireless network, because obviously wireless networks can be accessed from a certain range. You don't want other people to be able to access your wireless network without your permission, so you've got to put a password on it. But if you're messing around with the password settings and
Yeah, I mean, typically you've got to be careful because your wireless router will typically transmit. Well, they all say they transmit up to 100 feet from the unit, but that's not.
They never do. I've never had a wireless router work that far away. Even the ones that work very well, like the one I have right now, would probably get close to 100 feet because of how powerful it is, which is kind of surprising that it came from an ISP. Anyway, every other router, like the D-Links and the Linksys that I've used, I'm sorry, they would never go 100 feet. Reliably.
It also depends on what kind of building you're in, but the point I was going to make is that if you have a next-door neighbour, a very nosy next-door neighbour who's free internet, isn't willing to put his arms in his pockets and pay, he could access your unsecured wireless network. And if you're like me and have just upgraded your antenna to a bigger one, because you can do that on wireless routers as well, then it's likely that your signal's going to go much further. In fact, using WPA. Anyway.
Go into the city and turn on your laptop. If you have wireless on your laptop, you'll probably find an open Wi-Fi spot.
Which can be a nice thing to do, as long as you protect your data. You obviously don't want people hacking into your data if you want to share your internet connection. If you're feeling charitable, just open your router up with no security and just just encrypt your computers.
Yeah, I turned off file sharing and I just let people use my internet. I mean, who cares? I mean,
really useful thing to do, particularly if you're likely to be in an area
Yeah, I mean, I guess the best sort of situation is they should ask, but really, I mean...
As long as you're not using, as long as you're not, you know, it's common courtesy, as long as you protect your data.
And as long as you're not, like, using BitTorrent with no, with, like, very, like, no limits or anything, like, I mean, I don't really care. Go ahead.
Maxing up the router.
Yeah.
But it could hurt some people, especially if, you know, there was a case, actually, in Canada of a man who was charged with downloading child pornography.
Oh, yeah.
He discovered that it was a person outside his house in a car with a laptop using his wireless network. So you do have to be careful of that. But one thing on the router, which you can get in, which you probably mentioned about configuration, is something that people don't always know, is you can actually set up rules. Certain web addresses, certain domains, and I believe certain keywords can be blocked on most routers. So if you have if you use the keyword F blank blank K, and somebody could block that on a router and any website with that word, which
that's a little too stupid. Books,
could block it, or the word in that web address could be blocked.
I would use a little bit more of a word that might actually block stuff that would be. But I mean, I know what you
mean. I'm just giving an example. I believe you can block keywords in most routers.
Yes.
I just tried that thing a little while ago. So if you really want to...
Pretty sure kind of most of the routers I played with.
I mean, if you want to leave your internet open but want to be clever, then you can block the domains.
Actually, another thing you can do to block those kind of websites is you can use OpenDNS. OpenDNS.org will give you more information about that. And you can turn this on. Once you set up your, because it's just a different DNS server. Let's not get into what a DNS server is, but so you know, it will, if somebody tries to go to a website that the directory they used, I forget what it is, it's reputable, that thinks is child porn or pornography even, it will just say, no, you can't, you're not allowed to go to this website.
Now let me say that not all networks will allow you to configure to use OpenDNS.
No.
No, unfortunately.
If you can change the DNS servers on your router, it's probably best if you look yourself. If you can change the DNS...
In case of any problems or confusion, contact your router manufacturer. And they'll be the best ones to help you. Just say, I want to change my DNS server to OpenDNS. And they might say yes, they might say no, or they might just do it remotely, because sometimes
they can do that.
So yeah, the concept of setting one up is quite simple, because most manufacturers do provide a very nice quick start guide, which literally is a step-by-step guide.
And there's so much... If you can get access to the web otherwise, somehow, there's tons and tons and tons and tons and tons of tutorials online that are very helpful.
And again, you know, there's contacting the manufacturer. That is what their tech support is mostly trained for, walking you through it step by step. And an advantage to that is a lot of them, as I said, can, if there's any problems, they can say, oh, I noticed there's a problem. Or they could probably change a lot of your settings remotely, actually, especially if it's the people that give you your internet.
The point that we're basically... trying to make about these wireless routers is that, you know, if you can't follow the quick start guide, they've got illustrations. That's no use to VI people, but let's just say that a few years ago I was inexperienced about networking.
They tell you, I mean, if the interface is accessible, the start guide usually tells you to click on this link, right? So, I mean, you just go to the links that they tell you. I mean, if you can read the document, you should be fine.
Well, yeah, I mean, a few years ago I had no experience about wireless networking whatsoever. And I mean that literally. And I had my first D-Link router, and they gave me a quick start guide on CD in PDF format. Most manufacturers do that now anyway.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, after I read the quick start guide, I was able to follow it. And I think, because basically the way it works is, as I already said, you have a WAN port, don't you?
Yeah, and the WAN port is usually distinguishable, because it's usually like there's like a thing surrounding it, like a line or something, and it's a tactile line, so you can usually see that it's the WAN port versus the LAN ports, which are what you plug your local computers into if you're using a wired network.
Yeah, I mean, it's most likely it's the one on the left.
Yeah, most likely it's the one on the left.
So basically,
yeah.
Because basically, even the DSL ones, there are two types of internet, cable and DSL. Cable are the ones where you get a box from your provider, which is a cable modem that connects to the back of your PC, whereas DSL is where you connect through a phone line. Just briefly summarizing it. But even the ones with a phone line, they tend to have a, you know, the way you tell the difference there is that you have an RJ11 connector, which is smaller than RJ45.
Yeah, so RJ45 looks like an RJ11, like a very fat phone cord.
Yes.
And a phone line will not fit in an Ethernet plug.
No, it's too small.
It'll rattle.
Right. But it will, but it'll rattle around quite a lot and pop out again. So I think
it won't work.
You've done it.
Yeah.
So once you've basically hooked your PC up, the manufacturer will tell you to enter an IP address into your web browser. Obviously, you won't have a page displaying because you're not online yet.
Mm-hmm.
But once you've entered the IP address, again, you get a quick start wizard with most routers, if not all.
Some router
basically
guides
you through it.
I had a CD in, you put the CD in, and it set the whole thing up for me.
My, all of the routers that I've bought, my, all my Linksys and my D-Links worked out of the box. I plugged it into the, I had cable at the time, so when I plugged it in, it didn't have to register its MAC address or anything like that, like some ISPs like to make you do. So it just worked out of the box.
Yes, that is one thing to note about some ISPs. I was trying to, when I first got a router, I plugged in the the router. I did everything on the quick start guide, and I was not getting internet, and just was not getting internet at all. So I called my ISP and said, okay, what's going on here? And they said, well, you plugged in a new device, and you're only allowed 2 MAC addresses with your network. Now, MAC addresses are addresses, very specific addresses that each every device that connects to the internet has a MAC address. Computers, routers, yeah. And they're unique. It's sort of like a fingerprint. So, you know, if your computer, they're used for a lot of things, but your ISP, some internet service providers only like 2 devices connected to their network. Now, connecting a router kind of negates that because everything is using the router's MAC address. I needed to register the network's MAC address.
Mm-hmm. So that was pretty crazy.
The other important difference to note also is that, as Brandon was saying earlier on, there's 2 different types of routers. There's a wireless cable router and there's a wireless DSL router. A wireless cable router is used most commonly with cable companies. You plug them in and you're more or less set to go because most cable companies will pre-register their modems anyway, so you'll be pre-configured and all set to go on the internet.
Now, just to be clear, Mo, you're talking about wireless modem router combinations.
Yeah, a wireless cable router will not have a modem built in. But if you're getting your internet through a phone line,
from a DSL,
with a box plugged in via USB to the back of your PC, that is when you have to buy a router, a wireless DSL router, which is basically a router, but in place of the cable system, it has a DSL modem built in.
Yeah, I have one of those.
Now these wireless cable routers will work on DSL. You just need a DSL modem because I started out with a DSL modem. My ISP,
you can't get a cable router working. I mean, I currently have a cable router working with a DSL modem, but if you want
DSLs are more wireless modem combos. I just want to make that clear because, DSLs aren't just wireless routers. They are a modem as well, so you can plug it directly into the phone line. But a cable router is actually a wireless router because it doesn't have a modem built
in. Right.
Yeah, so basically the upshot is the only thing you need to watch out for basically is if you have internet through a phone line, you need to watch out for the word DSL on the box. If it's got the word DSL on the box, your router will work with your phone line.
Yeah.
Or if not, you don't really have to, as long as you have a modem, attached to your DSL phone. You don't really have to watch for that because you'll have a if you've got internet, then you've got a way to connect to it already, a modem.
Some ADSL modems don't have an Ethernet port at the back. believe it or not. The
what?
Ones supplied by by BT in the UK are just bog standard USB modems that plug into the back of the PC.
Ew. Really? Ew.
Yep. But BT have started supplying their own home hub. Yep, it's a BT wireless router.
Really?
It's a BT wireless router with an ADSL modem built in. Yep.
That's probably the same thing I have, actually, because BT is selling the 2-wire, which is the 2-wire gateway, which is what I have, which I love. I love
it. It's a huge router.
It's huge, but it's great. It's so reliable, though. It never crashes. Yes! Yeah. It's like the most reliable thing I've ever used.
Yeah. It's a good machine. Anyway.
Yes!
Oh, Fawn.
You're talking about Fawn. Oh, I know what you're talking about. I think it's kind of... I don't know. I don't see why people would need Fawn. Something like Fawn. It's a Web 2.0 startup that shares your Wi-Fi basically with anyone who comes around in the world. Like, it's worldwide.
But how does that...
You basically have two different
I think that's really good, actually.
I think it's a good idea. I just don't like the idea of being like, you have to be a Fawn member to use it. Like, yeah, it's sort of dumb.
Yeah, but... Well, I don't know, because, I mean, free internet is a good thing, you know, for the world. And as long as it's not going to detract from your resources, I think it's a great idea.
Is it worldwide?
Yeah, it's meant to be worldwide. It's a cool idea, but...
Got internet access. Why would you want to get internet access again?
Because if you're traveling and you want to get online and this person... and somebody's offering a Fawn... Wi-Fi hotspot. That's what it is.
The trouble is if you don't have Fawn.
Hold on. Like
if everybody's got to move to Fawn, have they?
In order for it to work. Yes, they do.
On BT, then you have to have a Fawn-enabled router. Apparently, BT are making everybody's router become Fawn-based.
Well, that's kind of nice.
Try me, then.
Oh, yeah, that's kind of nice. Yeah, Aiden. I'm
Except
sorry.
Except that you shouldn't have to be Fawn-enabled.
No, it shouldn't.
Yeah, but hang on a sec. Right? Hang on. Why should I replace my existing wireless equipment for them? I'm sorry.
They're just forcing
everyone
to upgrade their firmware.
So I'm sick.
Yes, you are. Well, it's not necessarily a bad thing. Like, really, it's a good service. It's just...
Basically, right, you know what I prefer to do, right? If I'm giving somebody free internet access, if I'm giving myself free internet access, I prefer to have decent speeds for a start.
Well, Firetrop isn't bad.
Safecom isn't a company based in China. And the routers that they make, if you install the firmware upgrade, if you use them, which most of our users won't do because they probably go for Belkin in the UK because that's more widely sold than ever. But if you use Safecom, which is available from specialist PC shops, then basically the way their routers work is you can set up multiple SSIDs. So for example, if you want one part of the network dedicated to you and you only with WPA access, then you can use one part of the network for network hardware that supports WPA, wireless protected access. And you can use basically another part of the network with WEP.
Does Safecom make a DSL router?
Yep, they make plenty.
I should buy one.
Routers, print servers, wireless cable routers, and everything.
I should buy a DSL router and then see if it's better than my 2-wire.
And believe it or not, their firewall, I tested out, I was doing a review of firewalls a couple of years ago. When Sygate was still running.
Mm-hmm.
And basically, I tested two or three routers' firewalls against the Sygate thing.
Mm-hmm.
Linksys firewall passed. Mm-hmm. I believe Netgear's passed. Safecom's mm-hmm. passed. D-Link mm-hmm. failed.
Yeah, it's figures.
D-Link did fail.
D-Link, for those who don't know, D-Link, for those who don't know, make routers that on review sites are known to be cheaply made. And they cut corners a lot?
Well, yeah, I mean, okay, they give you internet access, but the wireless tends to drop quite a lot on them. No matter whether you change the channel, whether you change the networking cables, whether you change the antenna.
Their interface isn't always great either. I think D-Link stands for delinquent as far as disability is concerned.
The newer interface is good, actually. I use the DI 624, which is really? I mean, it's an older wireless router in terms of
taste. I used to have that. It didn't work for me, but...
Oh, yeah. I was using it. It was great, yeah. Oh yeah, the 624 was good. The 604 sucked!
Yeah, I mean, if you're looking for a good naked router, we'd recommend either Lynx, have always been quite reliable.
Yeah, Lynx is good.
They've always been reliable. And basically, Safecom as well, they're quite reliable as well, and their routers also have extras built in. For example, you can, I believe on some of them you can do domain name filtering, word filtering, and they have plenty of extras like print servers built in, and they have USB connectivity for flashing your firmware if your router ever...
Nice.
...put, basically.
I want one.
They basically sell DSL modems and routers.
I've got to get one of the DSL ones and see if it works on my ISP.
I know, I think it will, and again, they're quite simple to set up, and you can select multiple profiles from multiple ISPs. So.
Well, I probably just have to, unregister the one I already have, basically, and then...
Well, yeah, it should be.
It should be fine. I think it'll be fun to try and switch and see what happens. Right now, for the to explain where I am in terms of my wireless network, I use a two-wire gateway, which my ISP gave me, which is a four-port DSL router with a web interface. Actually, what's interesting about the two-wire is all of the settings, like port forwarding and settings like that, are controlled through computer name instead of the IP address, which is really nice because...
Oh, that is nice, yeah.
Yeah, because it's so easy to do port forwarding because your computer name, unless you change it yourself, doesn't change.
Let me just go back a step here. We're talking about port forwarding. Basically, when you've got a wireless network, things like...
Any kind of a network.
Servers, things... Well, yeah, any kind of network. Things like FTP servers, which we talked about a few weeks ago, and file sharing, some file sharing platforms, they won't work because if someone will try and connect to your network, as they it will connect to your external IP address, which is basically the unique identifier. It was, before you got the network, the unique identifier of your computer. But now that you've got a network, it's actually the unique identifier of the network. So it goes to the router, and the router says, oh, well, there's an incoming connection here, but I don't know what to do with it, so I'm just going to get rid of it. So what you need to do is
configure... because you've got more than one PC. Previously, you had one PC and one PC only online, using one IP address, is what Matthew's basically trying to say, and now you've got four PCs using the same individual IP address online. So, for example,
what you've
got
to do
IP
is you've got to go into your router... And say on your router, say, okay, so if there's an incoming connection on port 21, which is the standard port for FTP, then send it to 192.168.2.3. What Brandon's saying is, because 192.168.2.3 is the internal address on the network of your computer, which you don't really need to know about.
It's just an example.
Yeah, what Brandon's saying is, on the type of router that he was talking about, then it's by computer name instead. So you could, if you've named your computer Matthew's Desktop, instead of saying 192.168.2.3, you can say send it to Matthew's Desktop instead, and it makes things a bit easier on the configuration front.
Ports can be very hard to set up. To give you an idea, Mobin and I spent... How many hours did we spend on that FTP server, Mo?
You must have spent 3 or 4 hours setting up your router to forward your FTP.
Yeah.
You eventually managed it. But
now I've got a new router.
FTP server behind your router.
Well, now I've got a new router.
On a non-standard port.
Yeah, well, now I've got a new router with DSL modem. So I think I might have my computer fixed by Friday. If that happens, or Saturday, if that happens, I may want to ask you to help me set it up again. Because that's...
Yeah, never again, basically.
Yeah, that'll be interesting.
But you only need to set things up on non-standard ports if your ISP blocks the ports.
Yeah, like FTP, for example. Sometimes ISPs will not allow FTP transfer.
Yeah, and you might also need to forward ports for games as well.
Yes.
Games do require internet access.
if anybody plays SoundRTS, that will you may need to forward ports if you try to host a server, because I've tried and I need to host a server.
Top Speed as well. Top Speed is a game. If you want to host an internet game, then you need to forward a specific port through. If you need to know more information, the manual of the game and the manual of the router is the best place to look. And the manual should, if it's a good manual, tell you that what port you need to forward and how it needs to be forwarded, etc.
Yeah, I mean, there's a very good website that instructs you how to forward ports and is an information source. It's called simply called www.portforward.com. And on that site is basically information about how to forward your ports, which ports certain applications require. And also what I will mention is, if you're not sure that you forwarded a port, for example, like for uTorrent or any other file sharing app, you can go to a website called www.canyouseeme.org. Spelled how it sounds, canyouseeme.org. And you can basically enter a port number, for example, like 21 if you're running an FTP server behind a router, for example. And it will basically ping you and tell you if your PC is accepting requests on that port.
Yeah, pinging basically means to connect very briefly and then disconnect. Servers,
yeah, I mean, I believe some HTTP servers and FTP servers do have an inbuilt self-test system, like HFS HTTP server, but most don't. So you can use canyouseeme.org in that respect.
Just to mention very briefly that some routers have something called UPnP in them, Universal Plug and Play, and some applications and some routers support this. I'm not quite sure how wide a standard it is. I know my Belkin router does support it, and the DC++ file sharing program supports it. And what that basically does is, if you have UPnP enabled on your router, you can say to a program such as DC++, use UPnP to automatically forward the necessary ports. As I said, sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't, and not all routers and programs support it, but if it's supported, it can be quite useful.
You can, yeah, because then it does it itself.
Yeah, exactly, and it helps applications to easily connect to the internet. Okay, we mentioned earlier on that basically you can have different forms of security for your network. If you have what's called an open network, then anyone from outside can walk into your house with a laptop and turn it on. A Windows XP will pop up a little balloon saying, "Wireless network in range! Click here to connect." And when you click on the balloon, a list of networks will come up. Obviously, one of the networks will be yours. It'll be your SSID, so if you called your network James, it'll be James. And when that person clicks
just
on James,
Windows
will
say... Just to mention that you have to set that SSID manually. It won't, when you buy the router, it won't automatically come and say, "Oh, well, your name is Matthew Horsepool, so come up as Horsepool."
Yeah.
You do need to set that manually.
Yeah. That is one of the things that's happened in configuration.
Yeah, most routers have an
SSID
set.
Sometimes it doesn't.
Sometimes
do that.
They don't.
Sometimes you might have a network that's just called Belkin 54G.
Yep.
Or
that's because nobody has changed the SSID from the default,
exactly,
which is at the manufacturer of the router usually.
So basically, if you basically have an SSID that you obviously recommend that you change that, but if you have one that's open, anyone can just walk in, and Windows will say, "Okay, are you sure you want to connect to this network? It is open. Your data can be seen by other people." And it can literally be seen, because there's no protection between you and the network. And then you click connect and then you're online. But that's where the different wireless security standards come in. There are two main types, WEP and WPA.
WEP
yes,
is the more...
Wired Equivalent Protocol, isn't it?
Yeah, and it's the more...
Privacy, actually. It's Wired Equivalent Privacy.
Yes, and it's the most accessible version of the two wireless security types, and it's the one that most, if not all, wireless routers support.
Wireless cards as well, that's the other thing.
Yeah.
For example, I have a wireless router that supports WEP and WPA, but my Braille Note, because it runs Windows CE 4.2, my Braille Note only supports WEP encryption, so I have to set my router to WEP. Similarly, my sister has a wireless card on her laptop, and that only supports WEP encryption.
It's what most devices and wireless cards support. It's sort of security that will stop most people from using it, but anyone who really wants to get into that network can crack the password quite quickly. There's programs to do it.
The only difference between WEP and WPA, wireless protected access, is with WPA you've got more advanced algorithms, basically. We're not going to go into too much detail of how it's encrypted.
Yeah.
Advanced algorithms. Encrypted data. I mean, with WEP you have a 24-digit key that you enter, whereas WPA uses 63.
And it's higher encryption too. It's much more encrypted. It's a lot harder for a program that somebody runs to get the password correctly quickly than it is with WEP. Like WEP, it can be done quick, but WPA takes a lot of time to get through.
You don't get a password. You get what's called a wireless key, and this wireless key is 25 characters that you have to enter. Now, as you talked about the icon last week, I went down to the state. I believe it's WPA. I'm not sure which one they have, but they have that one. And I used the icon down there, and I didn't have a USB keyboard then. I had to enter the 25-digit key in thumb braille, or 25-character key. That was very interesting. I actually got someone else there. I said, hey, you want to learn how to use thumb braille, don't you? So they had to do it, because that's a lot to remember, that key is.
Yeah. Now, with WEP, I noticed, this may just be my router, but WEP, when I was setting up my network, I could enter data in, or enter a password in, either ASCII, and now ASCII is your basic standard characters, A, B, C, 1, 2, 3, or I could enter it in hexadecimal, which is, it's still standard letters and numbers, but it doesn't make up words. You wouldn't make sense of it. And hex is longer, I think, than ASCII. For example, if I type the word Horsepool, which is my last name, H-O-R-S-P-O-O-L, in ASCII, if that was then converted to hex, it would come up as a much, much longer string of text, like, I don't know, 1F3B669CD, blah, 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 etc. And WEP supports both hexadecimal and ASCII keys. If it's an ASCII key, there's two different encryption levels as well. If it's at 64-bit encryption, I think it's, it is. It's 8 characters in ASCII, so just the word Horsepool will be sufficient. If it's at 128-bit, it's 13, I think. Although, don't quote me on that. And it has to be at those specific lengths with WEP. You couldn't have a 12-digit password, for example. It has to be a 13-letter password or an 8-letter password, otherwise it won't work. The final thing about WEP that I can think of is that there are several different key IDs that can be used, and this can be quite useful depending on how flexible your router is. But you could, for example, set up key ID 1 as Horsepool, key ID 3 as Matthew 1, and when you then go in and configure Windows, you'd have to put the password in, you'd have to then put the key ID in, and I assume certain routers can be set up to grant full access to key ID 1, just the internet to key ID 2. I don't know if that's even possible, but I assume it is on certain routers.
I believe some routers can, but most routers will basically have two or three different keys, and what they'll do is they'll switch between them.
If your device...
In my router, there's a combo box. It says, what do you want the default key to be? Do you want it to be 1, 2, 3, 4, or switch? Randomly switch. And if you set it to randomly switch, then it'll randomly switch, obviously.
But basically, the upshot of that is that we'd recommend you use WPA if all your hardware supports it.
Yes, yes.
Service Pack 1 doesn't support WPA, but Windows XP Service Pack 2 does.
Yeah, and many devices, if you buy a new device now, most devices that do connect to Wi-Fi support WPA. Some don't, but some do.
Any device within the last 12 months will definitely support WPA. Definitely.
Yeah.
Maybe that before that is a bit doubtful.
Yeah.
But there are two different types of encryption is in TKIP. If you leave it out of set to TKIP on the WPA PSK, pre-shared key setting, leave it set to TKIP, you should be okay. A is just another method of encryption, basically. We're not going to go into detail as to what the differences are.
No, we're not.
There are two options for WPA on each router. There's WPA and WPA PSK. If you're running a home network, we'd recommend you set it to WPA PSK. The first option, which just says WPA, will basically allow you to enter an address of a PC that's generating all your wireless network keys, whereas WPA PSK will allow you to input the key into the router that you're going to be using. So, like Matthew said earlier, like Matthew 1, for example. So it all depends on what you're going to be doing. WPA is a setting used mostly in corporate environments where they've got a radius server generating all the keys in real time. That makes the whole process a lot longer because then you have to sign certificates and give every piece. So yeah, it's not worth using WPA. So just leave it set on the WPA PSK setting. And if you're really stuck for a password to use, if you're one of these people that doesn't want to use your name or any password that can be found in the dictionary, there's a website online. It's www.grc.com/passwords. That's the www.grc.com/passwords. And basically, this is an online password generator. It will generate, literally, a huge string of text that you can use in the router. It will generate, for example, 25-digit key for WEP if you're using that, and a 63-digit one for WPA. And you can input that into your router's box, use that on all your machines, and go away. But some people find that more secure because it's random, and nobody can guess it.
The final thing we might want to talk about on the subject of encryption, and only very briefly, I have no idea what this is, by the way, but some people might come across the number 802.1x, and I have no idea what this is, so I don't know if anyone can explain it.
802.1x, I believe, isn't that just the variation of the network type?
Yeah, it's just a variation. I mean, you've got B and G, basically, at the moment.
B is slower than G. The max speed on B is 11 megabits?
Yeah, it is. 11 on B, and then on...
And then G, it's 54 megabits.
It's 108 on G.
No, it's 54. That's the double G, like the, I want to say expander or whatever. I believe it's 54 megabits on G. I'm pretty sure. Because the way they get the 108 is they use two radio waves. So, I don't know. From what I've heard, G is 54 megabits per second. In my textbook from a networking course that I took, it said that G was 54 megabits.
I thought 802.1x is an authentication type. Maybe not.
Not that I know of.
Okay.
Okay, now that we've briefly covered wireless security, I mean, there are plenty of sites online, like Brandon said earlier, where you can get all this info anyway, including the manufacturer's site that you buy your router from.
Hold on. Just as a side note, if you're looking to change ISPs or whatever, and you want to know which one is the best, Google DSL reports, and go to dslreports.com. They review all the cable and DSL providers, and they also have, you know, user reviews and forums and all that kind of stuff, and tutorials and all that kind of stuff if you need help. So, there you go.
Well, yeah, and you'll have user experiences. For example, here in the UK, we get a lot of people reporting that Virgin Media, who are formerly MTL, and Tiscali...
I hate them.
...notoriously the worst ISPs.
They're the worst ISP in the world.
I can possibly say that Virgin Media and Tiscali are both, one, rubbish on technical support and customer support, and secondly, they're absolutely rubbish on ISP, on the actual internet access to give you. Play of them.
Having said that, Virgin Media are great on the subject of ports, though. I can host any port I want on Virgin Media.
That's the thing about UK ISPs. UK ISPs don't packet shape. They're not restricted. If you go with somebody like BT or Pipex incidentally has got 20 years experience, so if you ring their techies up, whatever level of the experience yours is, they'll get your problem solved out in no time. But even if you set your network and send you out all the equipment free of charge, as most ISPs don't do except BT.
Yeah. Media extenders are built into a lot of things. Any new amp you buy, if you buy a new amplifier, chances are it has built-in Wi-Fi, or Ethernet sort of?
Basically, the function of a media extend, the most commonly, the way you'll know a media extend is around the home is, one, if you've bought an MP3 player with built-in Wi-Fi for surfing the internet and listening to online radio stations, or secondly, if you want to have media extender in your living room connected to your TV, which basically allows you to, if you've got a load of video files on your PC, or even a load of picture images even, or audio, you can basically broadcast that around your house. I mean, there was a guy here in the UK which basically has media extenders in every room all linked up to a server, all controlled remotely. So you can press any remote control in any room and watch any TV channel you like all through these extenders, and it's all wireless, which is pretty amazing. His whole house is going electrical.
Yeah.
But yeah, the point that I'm trying to make is that if you do want, you know, an extender in your living room, there's all sorts of options out there.
Yeah.
I would recommend having a house that obviously has a good wireless signal where you haven't got many things interfering, mm-hmm. And not many walls in the way, because you need 54 Mbps minimum, really, to share high-end, high-definition video.
Well, actually, if you're sharing high def, it won't work because high def is over 54 megs a second. I think the high def standard's like just over that. So, but most of us won't be sharing high def video because high def audio doesn't really, it doesn't, I mean, it's a few megs really if you're talking real like 5.1 high def, but it doesn't get much higher than but video does, but not audio.
Yeah, I mean, if you're just watching a normal MPG video or streaming picture, the network should be fine.
Yeah, and even DivX and all that kind of... If you're just watching a TV episode you downloaded or an Xvid or something, most of your downloaded stuff will be fine. It's when you are watching, like, an HD DVD or Blu-ray over your network when it starts to sort of get the bottlenecks. I mean, 802.11n, which is the new wireless standard... I think they actually broke the 100 megabits with that, which is basically as fast as a wired connection, so, and it's doubled the length that G had, which goes to 200 feet, if I'm not mistaken, and that will, allow people to get some nice, reliable, extenders going on in their house. It'll take a few years before, vendors, you know, start incorporating it because many routers don't have end support because I think it was recently finalized and there's the Apple Airport Express, which is the Apple's router that it supports, and a few other ones, but not very many of the ones that people are picking up support end yet.
Well, yeah, I mean, 802.11n again won't be implemented for another few years. They are gradually starting to implement 1 gigabit cards into PC instead of the 100.0 Mbps card we're using currently. But to be honest,
I have one. I have a gigabit card.
Yeah, I mean, firstly, you need a router that supports it.
Good luck.
Second, yeah, I know, and because they've not really come out yet.
No.
You need a new type of cable. I think it's Cat 6 now, isn't it? Are we on Cat
6? Are they using Cat 6? Oh yeah, because Cat 5 is 100 mega. Cat 6 is a gigabit cord because the Cat 5.
So basically,
they just split it off into more. I think is how they get the because more channels in the cable. That's how they get the gigabit, and it's a gigabit across the network. But still, it's nice to have that kind of spectrum of bandwidth.
Yeah, if you've got a wide network. Just touching on wired networking briefly, if you do have 100 Mbps, it's not going to be bad. I mean, I believe there is a new wireless network system coming out now, which is mains based. You plug something into the nearest socket to your PC, and it uses the electrical wires inside the walls of your house, transmits the whole of the network.
I want that.
I know. It's about 300.
Yeah, so ISPs are doing that now.
Yeah, Rogers. In Canada, you can buy a router that plugs into the wall, and it just works.
Yeah, exactly. You can basically plug a network card into each socket, whichever PC is near. You can basically plug a network card into a socket anywhere in your house, and you can basically have internet.
Aiden, have you looked into Rogers, and do you know the bandwidth limits and stuff?
No, I haven't looked into it.
Now, having said that, you know, Rogers is just like Shaw, so, you know, how much I hate Shaw, but I mean, if it's something I can carry around, who cares?
You mean something you can carry around, like plug into anywhere in the...
Yeah, well, I could come to your house and plug it in.
And you'd get internet?
Yes.
No. Well, why?
Like,
I'd
if
have
I...
to be...
No, you wouldn't have to be signed up. It's the modem that has your info. Once you hook it up and you they send a signal to wherever you are, I think, or they do it in store, one of the two, or they do it before they send it to you.
Cool. Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah, it's called Rogers Portable. Rogers.com/portable is where you can get more information.
Thank you very much. I think I might be looking at that.
It, you know, it's just like Shaw. Like, I'm like, they use the same, but still,
yeah.
Like, it's so useful that, you know, it doesn't.
I wish I could do that in the States. I guess I
no,
couldn't.
You can't.
Oh.
But it works in lots of. I think it works where you are, and it works in my. It works in the Lower Mainland.
Yeah.
So I mean, it's, and it's just so nice because you could plug it in wherever you want it.
Yeah, it's almost like those. Telus has an airtime card that, or I believe Shaw has that too. I'm not sure, but it looks like a cell phone.
Bell that has it.
Bell, I think Telus does too, because that's where Conan has it with Telus. And you plug it into your computer, and you basically it connects as a cell phone. It connects in any cell phone area to the internet, so you can be anywhere. Literally, you don't have to be with the plug. You can be anywhere. And if you pay enough, $50 a month, you can be in the world, like anywhere in the world, and it will then connect wherever a cell phone works.
So, what's the bandwidth limit?
Don't know.
One other thing I will mention is probably the whole world is going to be going wireless at some point.
Yes.
One interesting thing to note about the UK is that a scheme is now being trialed by, I believe it's BT and Pipex that are involved, and Pipex started it off.
Oh yeah, you guys are testing out WiMAX, hey?
We're going to get WiMAX. It's basically called WiMAX. It's a trial at the minute. They're basically trying to get down south first. Basically,
yeah.
It's where they make whole cities wireless, and each ISP, I believe, is going to have something in this. So I think Pipex and BT are going to be the first ones. And if you've already got a Pipex or BT account, when you connect to a wireless network run by one of these ISPs, they'll ask you to sign in with user ID and password, and basically you'll get free access to the internet anywhere. You could be in your car, or I don't know, at the top of a multi-story car park.
Yeah.
If you want to be up there, you know, on some dark night when you want to be alone, and get access to the internet and surf whatever sites you like.
Hey, Mum, I'm on the roof.
Yeah, yeah.
Exactly. Hey, Mum, you can't stop me here. I can go on whichever site I want, and you'll never even know.
Yeah, exactly.
WiMAX is going to be incredible when it's finally done all this testing. Like
they're testing in Oregon as well.
Yes, they're testing it in the States. Sprint and Cisco are in on it. So it's going somewhere. It is going to be great because it's something like 30 kilometers each base station, and so it's really easy to set up cities with it, and it doesn't interfere with each other because the signals just don't interfere like they do with local wireless networks. It's going to be awesome. I am really excited for it. If they don't air it up, that is. But I'm pretty sure that they've got some pretty key players that aren't interested in airing it up. It's going to be very interesting to see what happens.
And I'm afraid that's all we've got time for this week, so a big thanks to everyone who took part this week. If you'd like to get in touch with everyone at Vitek, there are two or three ways of contacting us. You can email vitekpodcast@gmail.com, or you can ring us now on our new telephone number, even though it's about 2 or 3 months old, on 0700-598-1840. That's 0700-598-1840. This won't work from outside the UK. And you can now also subscribe to our Google group by emailing vitekpodcast-subscribe@googlegroups.com. That's vitekpodcast-subscribe@googlegroups.com. It's been a pleasure hosting this show, and hopefully I'll be back soon to host the Christmas specials. Until then, goodbye, and thanks for listening.